The magic of the Balanchine production, the spectacular costumes, the enchanting deftness of the dancers, the compelling story of transformation, did what art is supposed to do. It transported him to a different world. Waiting for the imprint of the baseball to fade from his face, Waters taught himself every part in the ballet and began staging it repeatedly for his increasingly beleaguered parents. It was just full-on performance, he told me recently, still palpably proud. Curating the costumes, curating the entrances. For the role of Mother Ginger, Waters commandeered the family's sequined Christmas tree skirt. When he played a Russian dancer, his saber was one of the plastic candy canes that normally decorated the front yard. He made a stiff but fluttery tutu from pieces of a cardboard box. He even appropriated one of his mother's high heels to use as the slipper Clara hurls at the Mouse King to help defeat him. Harper is a whole lot of company, his mother, Janice Albergin, told me with great affection and some residual exhaustion. Because he wanted his production to be perfect, Waters continued to scrutinize the Nutcracker tape with the intensity of Balanchine himself. There was one scene that always stopped him, the one in which the women of the Corday Ballet leap across the stage as snowflakes on a winter night. Historically, it was meant to be a study in white, the white flakes falling from the ceiling, the white tutus of the dancers, the uniform faces of the dancers who were, of course, all white. But in the video, one dancer was not. There was one black girl in the core of the snowflakes. She obviously stuck out because, he paused and shrugged, snow white, dark skin. Why, Waters wondered, was there only one? Earlier this summer, I watched Waters produce and star in an altogether different sort of one-man performance. This one, an Instagram video sponsored by Converse and pegged to Pride Month. Waters sat on the concrete floor of a rented studio just south of downtown Houston, meticulously calibrating his iPhone on a tripod, his brow knit, his straight back perpendicular to legs splayed like a Raggedy Andy doll's. He is a slim, perfectly proportioned man with close-cropped hair and the musculature of a Greek statue. His shy smile lights his face from within. Many male ballet dancers possess a near-androgynous beauty, and Waters is no exception. His long, heart-shaped face sets off a heart-shaped mouth. His bright eyes telegraph mischief when he isn't intensely focused on the task at hand. On this day, he had draped his nearly 0% body fat frame in dad jeans and a faded, possibly ironic, have a nice day t-shirt. He'd also brought props, the most important of which rested inside a shoebox striped with the colors of the rainbow, a pair of jet black Converse high tops with the words "The Moment" displayed in clean white type above the heel. Pride is famously the time when people are supposed to come out, he explained in a voice that was both soft and authoritative. Waters is the lover of the singular moment, the one that embraces a particular drama, whether it be public, taking to the stage, or private, or both. He took the sneakers out of their box and ducked behind a white curtain into a makeshift dressing room. He emerged barefoot in a black leotard and padded to the center of the room. The walls were a stark white, the sun pouring in from the large windows bleached out any remaining color, so his body became an exclamation point on an otherwise blank page. The place was silent, save for the sound of Waters' feet changing position. He stood in front of his tripod and tried out a few poses. Then he lifted the sneakers above his head and opened his palms, letting the shoes clatter to the floor. He did this a couple more times before setting the action to music. a mix of talk show host Wendy Williams describing Lil' Kim, laid over a swirling percussive beat. She's an icon. She's a legend. She is the moment. Satisfied, Waters strode into the dressing room and came out in another ensemble, a mesh t-shirt and some elbow-length black gloves. There were more poses, one with the glove extended as if he expected someone to kiss his hand. Next, a sequined jacket. Like, I would never wear this, he confessed, a little abashed. Finally, he appeared in a leopard-spotted leisure suit, accessorized with, of course, the sneakers. Each time the camera rolled, Waters put on an expression of hauteur that is common to both ballet dancers and catwalk stars, two types of performers with whom he is entranced. After 40 minutes of costume changes, he sat down at a table and started editing the various takes on his laptop, dropping in photos of gay black icons whose poses he had been imitating in tribute all along. These included, but were not limited to, Miss J. Alexander from America's Next Top Model, Jeremy Pope from Pose, and Lil Nas X, wearing a far more expensive leopard print leisure suit than Waters. The final cut was a 16-second montage in which the key song lyric, She is the Moment, takes on an entirely different meaning, the words becoming a kind of gay anthem. Waters studied his work, then turned to me. His eyes were bright, his smile radiant. In that moment, he looked exactly like an 8-year-old boy who couldn't wait to show the world what he could do. Waters recently celebrated a decade with the Houston Ballet Company, which he commemorated, fittingly, by creating a reel of his greatest hits set to Beyoncé's Countdown. He will tell you that he is first and foremost a ballet dancer. My life's work has been ballet, and that is demonstrably true. He's the highest-ranked black dancer within one of the country's most prestigious and innovative companies. Depending on how you calculate it, the Houston Ballet is either the 5th or 6th ranked company in the U.S. But Waters is also one of those people who, because of intelligence, talent, and general restlessness, cannot contain himself. His life as a social media sensation began almost by accident, when, in December 2014, a fellow dancer wanted to stage a drag night among friends and brought in two pairs of pink heels. This was a time when five of the male dancers in the company were intensely close, all around the same age as Waters was then, 21. We were thick as thieves, he said. It was like we were a cult. Still, the shoes made them nervous. We were fine with being flamboyant, Waters said, but this idea of drag seemed to be taboo. But the shoe bearer was leaving the company. They couldn't turn down his final request. So Waters and another dancer, Reese Kosakowski, put on the heels and ran around the ballet's gym like, well, proud gay men in pink stilettos. Then Waters posted the video on his Instagram. Suddenly he was watching the number of likes soar. In retrospect, it wasn't a lot of views, Waters said, but it was enough to suggest new possibilities. Oh my God, Reese, we are celebrities, he told Kosakowski. We need to do this again. They did, worrying much more about lighting and choreography and music. For one of their creations a few years later, they queued up Fergie's Fergalicious, hopped on side-by-side treadmills and started prancing, dancing, racing, and more. At one point, Waters did the splits across the two treadmills' handles. The video got more than 1 million views, and Harper Waters became a viral sensation. In the time since, his posts have run the proverbial gamut, from a reel of him performing as the prince in, yes, the Houston Ballet's version of the Nutcracker, to Waters sashaying down a Manhattan street, his body concealed under a voluminous coat of pink ruffles. Other posts feature Waters in various dance, fashion, and LGBTQ magazines, and there are many, many photos of Waters the influencer, often accessorized in some measure of drag. Boxes of swag mailed to him from RuPaul's Drag Race send him into a swoon. "I'm friends now with a lot of the queens from the show," he told me. It's a real full-circle moment. His list of clients is long and growing and includes MAC Cosmetics, Abercrombie & Fitch, and Polo. Companies send him everything from platform heels, he's inundated with them, to deodorant and more in hopes of a promo. One of his recent videos featured a Christmas morning style opening of a mountain of packages from a kitchenware company. Waters performed a pas de deux with a hefty Dutch oven. During the pandemic, after the Houston Ballet closed its doors, his fame continued to grow. Waters' videos became a kind of therapy, not just for his viewers, but also for Waters himself. The loss of an entire season from a dancer's career, which can span less than a decade, was traumatic. "It was a dead stop," said Waters, now 29. "To have studios closed down, there was no space to move, to train. It was like my powers were being sucked out." The rise of the Black Lives Matter movement also inspired him to make more overtly political content. Waters is a gay black man in one of the most rigid, gendered, and segregated art forms in existence, classical ballet. In the past, that would have made him an outcast, but he has now achieved a degree of fame uncommon in the world of dance. In fact, Waters has doubled the Instagram followers of his employer. Today, the Harper Waters brand promotes dance alongside LGBTQ and black issues. The content is often sponsored by corporations that are, depending on your point of view, supporting or exploiting those causes. But his brand is also sui generis. In his videos, Waters turns tropes about queerness and masculinity on their head. Rather than tapping into outrage, the go-to move on social media, he disarms. The implicit question Waters poses is, if I can have so much fun, why can't you? Even when he is serious, he has a light, absurdist touch. In an Instagram post from December 2020, he used a split-screen effect to parody a video of a maniacally smiling white guy who gradually changes from a t-shirt and shorts into combat fatigues while he pantomimes shooting a pistol over a soundtrack of tinkly music and gunshots. On the other side of the split screen, Waters, wearing workout gear, watches him contemplatively, maybe a little contemptuously, until the final moment when he cuts to himself in red heels, aviators, a giant afro wig, and a turquoise mini dress of billowing tulle. Somehow the juxtaposition makes the combat guy look, well, ridiculous. Waters had stumbled upon the video while scrolling through TikTok recommendations. Maybe the algorithm had a sense of humor and quickly came up with a concept. "I just thought it was such toxic masculinity," Waters said. A recent project with Reebok also showcases Waters' insistence that ballet requires just as much athletic prowess as more macho competitive sports. Linebackers, after all, don't have to lift another human above their heads and carry them around for extended periods, all while making it look effortless. Harper is breaking down these boundaries of what an athlete is, said Christina Jones, Waters' representative at Digital Brand Architects. Like most successful influencers, Waters has both an agent and a branding company behind him. His success has brought plenty of material benefits. Waters recently bought a one-bedroom townhouse not too far from the ballet, and this year was the first time he's ever had to hire an accountant. "What are you talking about?" he asked when the accountant brought up deductions. Waters isn't the only dancer to use social media to his advantage. Misty Copeland, the first black principal dancer with the American Ballet Theater, arguably the country's most prestigious company, has 1.8 million Instagram followers. While she uses her platform mostly to highlight her dancing, she has also reckoned with the racism of the ballet world to great effect. James Whiteside, a principal dancer and choreographer also with ABT, has 345,000 followers, who are treated not only to his rehearsals, but to his life as a gay man with a love of drag. Waters' situation is different because, as a soloist, he ranks below principal, the highest position company dancers can achieve. His videos have made him a star, unlike Copeland or Whiteside, whose star power in ballet gave them social media cred. Waters has become a change agent, not just through circumstance, but through force of will. In turn, he may be amassing a power few dancers have commanded in the past, when artistic directors had total say over which dancers got what roles, how they performed them, how much they were paid, and what opportunities they were afforded in their careers. There's very little fairness in that world, or even the idea that fairness should be in that world, explained Julia Folks, a cultural historian at the New School in Manhattan. The world of dance may consider itself a meritocracy, she continued, but that meritocracy has been manipulated by race, by who is somebody's muse, by who is sleeping with who, at least up to now. I've always been self-aware, Waters told me one day when we were chatting over Zoom. The phrase comes up often when he talks about the formative elements of his past, but each time I heard it, I wondered whether he was mixing up self-awareness with self-consciousness, whether he was still sorting out the difference for himself between being watched and being seen. When I was a kid, I quickly realized I was adopted because of how people would look at my family asking, "Are you guys together?" There's something almost Dickensian about Waters' story. He was born in Atlanta and was immediately put up for adoption. His biological father was incarcerated at the time, and little is known about his birth mother, except that she had a deep desire to give her child a better life than her own. Working with an agency, she chose as his parents a New England couple, Janice Albergeen and David Waters. On the basis of autobiographies she'd requested from several couples. She was black, they were white. They were literature professors and both earned doctorates from Brown University. David became a New Hampshire state senator in 2012 after serving several years in the lower house. Janice taught at Fitchburg State University and is an expert in children's literature. The couple was comfortable, not rich, but what must have come through was a commitment to raise a child whose differences, whatever those might be, would be nurtured. What was wonderful about Harper is how he led us into new places and helped us understand who he needed to be, David told me. Waters seemed to have known early on that if he was going to be watched, he might as well give people something to look at. It helped that he was preternaturally charming. In stores, he would just naturally attract other people's attention, Albergeen said of routine shopping trips with her son. An active kid, Waters was always moving, always restive. He had the ability and desire to turn everything into a performance. When he showed an interest in gymnastics, his father bought him a balance beam. Waters, in turn, staged a mini Olympics with his parents as judges every night before supper. He would do these elaborate routines, David recalled. We would have to sit there silently and put up pieces of paper that held the score. It couldn't be a 9.8. It had to be a 10. Eventually, his parents put him in a dance class in their neighborhood. I thought, damn it, kid, if you want to dance so much, you can dance in front of other people besides us, Janice said wryly. That was it. After encouragement from various teachers, Waters applied for a summer ballet program, which, once completed, made two things clear to the then 14-year-old. He wanted to be a dancer, and he was gay. He later explained his next move in Teen Vogue, and typical of Waters, played all parts in the ensuing drama. I remember watching an episode of America's Next Top Model, completely enthralled by the statuesque glamazon that is Miss J. Alexander. I'm not sure if it was his confidence, his shade, his melanin, or all of the above, but it motivated me to come out to my parents that day. I felt like Tyra Banks, and my parents were the two models in front of me. Instead of their photos, I had my sexual identity to share with them. When I told them, I immediately felt a weight lifted off my shoulders. Still, it must have been anticlimactic. Oh, honey, his mother said, taking her son in her arms, we kind of knew. By then, Waters had already, successfully, lobbied his parents to send him to an arts boarding school in Massachusetts. Despite being a gifted athlete, he had been bullied in elementary school for being effeminate. I was an only child, closeted growing up. I didn't have sleepovers. I was never invited to group things, group hangouts. I think I was really hungry for affection, he told me. At boarding school, he found himself at last surrounded by kids more like himself. Many talented boys drop out of dance because of bullying by their peers. But Waters had navigated himself into a safe space where he could also freely binge on the popular culture he adored, MTV, musical theater, and Queer Eye, which he had watched covertly at home. The summer before his senior year of high school, he secretly auditioned for and was accepted into a year-round dance program, the Houston Ballet Academy. When he finally told his parents, they had to let him go. The hunger was just radiating off Harper, Janice recalled. In 2009, the 17-year-old took his place at the bar, finishing high school online the next year. As far as Harper and dance, I've always said he was the engine and we were the caboose, Janice told me. He was just going forward. Stanton Welch, the artistic director of the Houston Ballet, said that when Waters was starting out as a student in the academy, he was a very interior person, not the online Harper at all, almost an introvert. He was kind of in his brain solving problems. As he became more comfortable, a more carefree, somewhat overconfident Waters emerged. Soon after, he discovered that his teachers were not as willing as his parents to award him perfect tens. But he listened and learned and threw himself into punishing work in the studio. He became what he and other dancers describe as a bunhead, all work and very little play. But the sacrifice paid off. By 2011, he earned a coveted spot as a member of the company. The same year, he won several awards for his dancing, including first prize in contemporary dance at the prestigious Prix de Lausanne Ballet competition. In 2017, he was made a soloist. He is someone who has never stopped growing, Welch said. The confidence he gained online he directed into his work. There was something else, too. Because his father worked in politics as well as education, Waters was exposed to a class of people that few others encounter, specifically the presidential candidates and major donors who paraded through New Hampshire every 4 years. From an early age, he knew how to talk to strangers, including the likes of Al Gore and the Clintons, which later served him well at Houston Ballet fundraisers. At the annual gala, he just makes it more fun for everybody, former board chair Phoebe Tudor told me. Harper turns up in some fabulous outfit, and he dances with other dancers and patrons. Waters also owes his success to a fateful synergy. Yes, he was smart and clever and enjoyed a mutual love affair with the camera, but his dance career was also taking off in tandem with a much wider acceptance of the LGBTQ community. The Supreme Court legalized gay marriage in 2015. Around that time, RuPaul's Drag Race became mainstream TV, as well as the explosion of social media. There's a culture and a connection between drag, gay men's worlds, and the dance worlds, and it's just being put on display now and more overtly than it was in the past, said Folks, the cultural historian. Straight fans may not realize that Waters posing and prancing has antecedents in the black and Latino ballroom scene of the 60s and 70s. As dancers, every performance is like a drag show, Waters said, quoting a mentor. The costumes, the makeup, the lavish sets, and often the movement in classical ballet tend to be over the top for a reason. A dancer has to convey emotion to an audience member in the highest balcony without saying a word. So a few episodes of Drag Race can be instructive. At the same time, male dancers are still expected to appear hyper-masculine in the old narrative ballets, which means many performers have to hide who they are when on stage, that they have bodies perfected to a masculine ideal, and spend hours in constant motion lifting 100-pound women isn't always enough. As Whiteside, the American Ballet theater star and sometime drag queen, explains in his new autobiography, Center, Center, the gulf between man and woman is deep in the world of classical ballet. The stories simply don't allow for much variation, unless you're some sort of mincing villain. I thought that by becoming a ballet dancer I was doing something super gay, but it turns out my life's work is just another heteronormative endeavor. That is evolving as new choreographers change the substance of ballet. Men are no longer cranes whose main purpose is to lift women and carry them across the stage. Newer works feature men dancing with men and women dancing with women in less gendered, more abstract roles. As Folks explained, someone like Waters is making gender fluidity a part of the conversation in a form that was founded upon the notion that women do this and men do that. Modern dance began to break that apart. Ballet has resisted that change, and now it's being pushed to the forefront with dancers like him. Still, the self-consciousness that bedevils all dancers who spend their careers practicing in front of a mirror remains. Waters recalled corrections from ballet masters, as in, "Your hips are moving too much," and found that his creativity was stifled when he forced himself to be conventionally masculine. It wasn't until he began experimenting with gender on social media, see the infamous Pink Heels video, that he found he could free himself to be a better dancer. "I came out of the closet literally and figuratively, thinking I had to put on a costume to do something, when I was fine as I was," he said. "Not that it's always easy. I spit on the animal that gave you birth," someone once commented on Waters' Instagram. Wrote another, "Lord, I pray for this man's demons to come out of him. He is not a she," and so on. In response, Waters did what Waters does. In an Instagram post, he took screenshots of the comments and layered them alongside a photo of himself dancing. It probably says a lot about the cultural status of classical ballet that one of the premier dancers in the field can order a coffee without being recognized. But that is what happened, or didn't happen, when Lauren Anderson stood at the counter of Houston's EQ Heights coffee shop to pay for her iced latte. Her pointe shoes may be on display at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, but none of the caffeine addicts hunkered over their laptops in the shop on Heights Boulevard bothered to even glance up at her. Anderson is not particularly tall, but her biceps would make Terminator star Linda Hamilton think twice about challenging her to an arm wrestle. More to the point, she speaks so intensely and her gestures are so expansive that you might suspect she is somebody, even if you don't know exactly who. In fact, in 1990, Anderson became only the second black female principal dancer in a major American ballet company. Deborah Austin, with the Pennsylvania Ballet, was the first in 1982. From the time she joined the Houston Ballet in 1983 until her retirement in 2006, Anderson toured the world with and was the star of The Company, where she still remains as a director of education and community engagement. Anderson first spied Waters in 2009 when he was that shy, gangly 17-year-old member of the summer program. Whenever I see a child, and I'm going to be specific, a black child walk in the doors of Houston Ballet Academy, I am on them, Anderson said. Like so many people before and after, she succumbed immediately to the Waters aura and became his protector and mentor. I saw this sweet, protected child I just wanted to nurture. I wanted to make sure he was okay emotionally. I didn't have to worry about him technically being okay, because he was in the best place for that. So protective was Anderson that in an early meeting she threw some serious shade at the white woman who was grilling her about Houston, before realizing the woman was Waters' mother. Waters slipped into EQ a few minutes after Anderson, and she hugged him like a son. The difference in their ages, Anderson is now 56, meant they could be taken for parent and child, especially when Waters began advising her on making her first TikTok post. "Let me look into some trends," Waters said, beginning to scroll intently through his phone. "I already have some ideas." A discussion of costuming followed. "I've got pumps," Anderson said excitedly. Then Waters started talking about a split-screen duet. Once he tagged her, voila. She would have instant followers. "You mean I've got to interact with these people?" she asked, stricken. Seeing how close they were, it was hard not to think of something else they had in common. Anderson's and Waters' success can be at least partly attributed to geography. Most stories about exceptional Texas arts institutions have two things in common. Usually, the organizations were created in something of a vacuum, on the belief that it was better to grow your own talent than to import it. And most were supported by board members with deep pockets who were committed to transcending negative Texas stereotypes. That's how an Englishman named Ben Stevenson came to be artistic director of the Houston Ballet in 1976. Before the ambitious board hired him, he had danced in some of Britain's most prestigious companies and had been a director of the National Ballet in Washington, D.C. He would spend the next 27 years building the Houston Ballet, formed in 1955, from an eccentric local troupe into an international sensation, with a broad, often daring, repertory. One of his first acts was to further professionalize the company by establishing an academy to train its own dancers, and end the ballet's dependence on visiting guest stars, as was common in many second-tier companies. Stevenson was famously and uniquely willing to hire and promote dancers of color, which enabled him to nurture and then feature principals like Li Xuanxing and Carlos Acosta, male dancers of spellbinding power and grace. And there was Anderson, who started as a child at the School of Ballet before winning entry to the company as a teenager. She still remembers the gasps in the audience when they first caught sight of her as the Sugar Plum Fairy in her first Nutcracker performance. A few years later, she demurred when Stevenson cast her in the starring role in Alice in Wonderland. "I can't be Alice," she told him. "Alice is white." For his trouble, Stevenson got death threats for putting Anderson in lead roles, and she controlled her demons and her physical pain for a time with alcohol and cocaine. At her best, though, there was no one like her. Anderson challenged the stereotype of the fragile ballerina with a joy and a dynamism that was like nothing before or since. She was Stevenson's muse, dancing in ballets he created specifically for her to international acclaim. As Anderson's frequent partner, Acosta said in a Houston ballet documentary, "We were able to break the ice and break this mold in Houston." It would be nice to think that times have changed completely for black dancers in the period between Anderson's career and Waters, but that just isn't so. Classical ballet was created by and for elites, white men of European ancestry, and such men still control most classical ballet companies. For the most part, dancers are still built a certain way: tall, thin, light-skinned. The uniformity of the line was always paramount and continues to be. Major ballet companies around the world still hew to that aesthetic, aside from those specifically created for black dancers, such as Dance Theater of Harlem and the Alvin Ailey Dance Company. Many black dancers are automatically advised to try for slots in those companies as their best shot at a professional career, or to switch to modern dance, where the choices are broader. Just this August, Makar Vaziev, the artistic director of the famed Bolshoi Ballet in Moscow, defended his use of blackface in a particular ballet by claiming, "Yes, there is some use of blackface, but it's very sweet and everything is done with love." Listening to Anderson and Waters compare careers, then, is both inspiring and frustrating. Both credit the Houston Ballet, Stevenson, and in Waters' case, its current artistic director, acclaimed Australian choreographer Welch, with giving them safe harbor to be themselves and to grow on and off stage. It's more like a family than most hierarchical ballet companies. Welch actually encourages his dancers to have children, and most Houston dancers of color would say they faced more racism from visiting choreographers or while touring than within the company. Still, classical ballet is as rigid in its structure as the military, and the persistent popularity of the old story ballets, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, and Swan Lake, to name only a few, have historically meant white faces on stage. "You just weren't right for the part," remains a statement long used by artistic directors as a cover for discrimination. The reckoning that followed the murder of Houstonian George Floyd at the hands of the Minneapolis police last year, however, finally forced some hard conversations. In a fairly unprecedented move, the leadership of the Houston Ballet held multiple Zoom meetings to discuss current concerns and past grievances, including previously unacknowledged racism in upcoming productions such as Madame Butterfly. Anderson and Waters were tapped to help expand diversity programs and create a conversation series called Breaking Boundaries, which highlighted local dancers of color, past and present. The stories those dancers told weren't so different from the stories black dancers have told for decades. They get complaints about not powdering their faces white enough or not dyeing their shoes dark enough to match their skin color. Only recently have manufacturers begun making ballet shoes for dark-skinned dancers on a large scale. Hair is also an issue. Looking the part is another way of saying you have to look like the white people here to pass for the prince. There were African princes with this haircut. Nazir Muhammad, a black dancer from Brooklyn, noted of his fade at the time, "Maybe just not a Disney prince." Most black dancers have had the experience of being the only one in a rehearsal room, or worse, being one of two and knowing that just one of them is likely to be included in a piece. Black dancers also worry that speaking up will paint them as too loud, too aggressive, too angry. In turn, a kind of self-ownership and self-sabotage sets in. Waters, like Anderson, at certain times stopped envisioning himself in some classical roles because he didn't believe he would ever be allowed to perform them. And though some of the conversations after Floyd's death were productive, Waters also found himself cast in an uncomfortable role common to black people in most white organizations, that of official spokesperson for his race. "I definitely felt like I had a responsibility to speak up, be a leader," he said. "I was the highest-ranked black dancer in Houston. I have a platform. I have no problem speaking my mind, but what I didn't anticipate was the pressure and weight that would bring, given the intensity of the topic. Calling out an organization's missteps as a dancer, a role that is incredibly subservient, was difficult. I felt like I was overstepping. I was nervous of repercussions. I didn't want my dancer hat to be revoked because I was using my justice hat. It became too much. So I distanced myself from that work with Houston Ballet." Ultimately, he felt the act of dancing, of being a black man on stage, was the best way for him to bring about social change. "There are things I want to accomplish as a dancer, which I believe is political in itself. Who I am, who I love, what I look like," he said. As of today, the Houston Ballet has 5 black dancers in a company of 59, which is a higher proportion than at other prominent companies. Waters, like Anderson, believes change will take time, that success will come with more recruitment and training. Anderson has been especially active in Houston's public schools. "You can't just snap your fingers and have a diverse company," Waters said, "and you can't just shove someone out on stage expecting them to execute difficult moves because they look a certain way. The work has to be done outside the studio, and I hope ballet companies do that. It's hard to have dreams if you don't know it's possible." In mid-July, Waters started eyeing a welcome return to the stage. He was selected to join several other members of the company to perform at the famed Massachusetts dance venue, Jacob's Pillow, at the end of the summer, and he was as anxious as he was excited. "It's weird to wake up and have the first thought be performance," he told me, a nervous laugh revealing his jitters. "It's such a weird moment right now. I didn't know how much I needed it." In a cavernous, almost painfully bright rehearsal studio at the Houston Ballet, I watched Waters rehearse a piece called Reflections. It was created by Justin Pack, a young choreographer at the top of his game. The music is a poignant piano duet, and the work is performed on a mostly empty stage, just the dancers and 2 players at their pianos. There are no princes or princesses and no elaborate costumes. The studio was empty, save for a ballet master, the accompanist at the piano, and three dancers. A female principal, Karina Gonzalez, and two male soloists, one of whom was Waters. His focus was total and self-critical, with no sign of the sly wit he adapts so often in real life. "I overprepped it," he said of a move, anticipating a correction from the ballet master. "I stopped too soon." The dancers were executing what is known as a pas de trois. Gonzalez was as light on her feet as she was confident, while the two men were all sinew and muscle, twisting their bodies like bending branches in a wind, perpetually changing direction. Sometimes the men came together and then pulled apart, grasping each other by the wrist. Sometimes Gonzalez slipped between them, separating them for a bit before all three danced together again. Their movements went from airy to reserved to almost percussive, together, alone, together, apart. The old steps presented in new ways for new audiences who might not even notice that all three dancers were black or Hispanic. That's how it went for the next hour or so, until all three were drenched in sweat and panting. About 6 weeks later, at the end of August, they performed Reflections flawlessly on an outdoor stage, amid the sweet, cool air and rolling green hills of the Berkshires. The Rave and the Boston Globe singled out Waters and Gonzalez for their surprisingly rare, true dance partnerships. They move like a flowing river, like it's the most natural thing in the world. Reading the review, I thought back to the boy who staged the Nutcracker over and over again. "I felt unstoppable in my living room," Waters had said, his eyes glowing. "I turned the lights off and used the dimmer switch on our chandelier. I was in a spotlight. I would hide behind the edge of the hallway, and that was the curtain. I was entering a stage," he continued. "This was a performance. There was never anyone saying, 'You're gross, you're different,' or 'Boys can't do that.' It was just," he said, pausing to recapture the moment, "everything."
From the editor, Food for the Soul. Reading time, 5 minutes. When a friend introduced me to someone at a San Antonio barbecue joint this summer, the stranger asked, "Does Daniel Vaughn work for you?" I replied that at that moment I was working for Daniel, and so were roughly 36 colleagues. Daniel is our full-time barbecue editor, the only one, as far as we know, at any American publication. Most of the time he works alone, roaming the state, seeking out the best new joints and checking in on old favorites. But every 4 years, he leads a small army of tasters who help curate our list of the top 50 barbecue joints. This year, Daniel recruited a record 34 helpers. Combined, we sampled the queue at 411 joints and traveled tens of thousands of miles to every corner of Texas. Each taster first had to take a course from Daniel, and we used a rubric he'd developed for judging. Say, the snap of a sausage link and the tenderness of a brisket slice. Once we turned in our assessments, Daniel and Patricia Sharp, our fine dining writer, revisited the joints that scored highest. The cost of this project, in greasy receipts alone, tallied about $30,000, and it was worth every penny to better inform our judgments and help us tell the stories of the state's best pitmasters. Our reporting reminded us that, with so much dividing Texans these days, our love of great barbecue unites us. The state's pitmasters are setting a fine example for balancing change and tradition, even as upstarts serve innovations, such as smoked pork banh mi and brisket birria ramen. Most also lovingly prepare the Texas trinity of brisket, pork ribs, and sausage. Meanwhile, veteran proprietors of traditional joints are experimenting with new sauces, side dishes, citrus beet salad, anyone? And desserts. Daniel's love of barbecue began when he was a teenager in Wooster, Ohio. His mom worked long hours cleaning houses, and Daniel helped out at home by doing some of the cooking, which included baking pork ribs in the oven and finishing them on a gas grill with lots of red sauce. That, Daniel recalls, is what I thought barbecue was, until a family trip through the South. Stopping in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, they dined at Dreamland Barbecue, famed for its hickory-smoked pork ribs and heavenly sauce. I learned that great barbecue isn't just delicious, he recalls, it's food for the soul. After earning a master's degree in architecture, he got a job working for a design firm in Dallas and began making pilgrimages to the high temples of Central Texas Q, including Louis Miller Barbecue in Taylor. He then started discovering joints in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that were excellent but little known. By 2008, he'd launched a popular barbecue blog as a side hustle. A few years later, we persuaded Daniel to quit his day job to cover Q for Texas Monthly. At last count, Daniel had sampled more than 1,900 joints, most of them in Texas, but also as far afield as Raleigh and Copenhagen and Madrid. He's not only a world-renowned expert on barbecue, but also an inquisitive reporter and a warm and vivid storyteller. This year, instead of our big annual barbecue event in which dozens of top pitmasters offer their meats in one location, we held smaller, socially distanced gatherings in Brownsville, Lubbock, and Tyler. We hope the pandemic eases enough for us to revive the big event next fall. We've also just relaunched our Texas Monthly BBQ Finder app. It will help you locate the best joints wherever you might be traveling in our great state. You can download it at the Apple App Store and at Google Play. You'll find Daniel's latest reviews there and at texasmonthly.com. Whatever you like to drink with your Q, Daniel prefers Dr. Pepper, Topo Chico, or champagne. I hope you'll join me in raising a glass to our barbecue editor and all the fine Texas pitmasters featured in this issue. Dan Goodgame, Editor-in-Chief, Roar at TexasMonthly.com.
Meanwhile, in Texas, previously unseen 113-million-year-old dinosaur tracks were revealed after the Paluxy River at Dinosaur Valley State Park receded during excessive drought. A man broke into an Abilene animal shelter, freed more than 150 dogs from their cages, stole a van, and escaped before detectives eventually found and arrested him. After the electricity went out at his clinic, a Travis County urologist performed a vasectomy by plugging a surgical tool and a fan into a power outlet in his electric vehicle. U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers in Laredo seized a truck filled with 1,953 packages of cocaine worth more than $11.8 million, disguised as baby wipes. An artist in Houston installed a 5-foot-tall sculpture of a molcajete filled with guacamole beside a busy intersection to pay homage to the indigenous cultures of Mexico. The University of Texas at Austin announced a new course for the fall semester examining the lyrics of pop star Taylor Swift, which will be compared to the poetry of Shakespeare and Keats. In the spring semester, Texas State University will offer a class on the singer and actor Harry Styles. Dallas firefighters complained to city officials after receiving wellness kits that included massagers that resembled sex toys. After officials arrested a DoorDash employee on a series of traffic warrants, an Alvin Police Department officer completed the driver's Chinese food delivery, telling the recipients, "Well, your DoorDash driver is going to jail, but I wanted to get you your food." Sierra Juarez.
Thank you for joining us for Texas Monthly, the national magazine of Texas, read by volunteers and staff at the Recording Library of West Texas. You can hear this program on demand with your favorite device at recordinglibrary.org. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Make Believe Ballroom, followed by the History Book Hour at 9. Here's what's happening on the Noon Book Hour. Starting Thursday, January 5th, we're reading At Bluebonnet Lake. Marketing maven Kate Sherwood's world is fast-paced, challenging, and always changing. The last thing she wants to do is slow down to a crawl at Rainbow's End, a dilapidated resort in the Texas Hill Country. But she cannot die her ailing grandmother's request to visit the place where she and her deceased husband spent one glorious week 50 years ago. There, Kate meets Greg Vange, the resort's handyman. But there's more to Greg than meets the eye. Billions more, in fact, as he recently sold his successful software company and is at the resort in search of what's next in his life. Kate isn't looking for romance, but she can't deny the sparks of attraction that fly every time she and Greg are together. She even starts to see potential in the rundown resort. Could there be a future there? Or will Kate's long-sought promotion take her back to the big city? At Bluebonnet Lake, starting Thursday, January 5th. The Noon Book Hour, weekdays at noon and 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 50 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Hi folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music in traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S., as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world and from coast to coast on public university and community radio stations, welcome, welcome, welcome one and all to the Make-Believe Ballroom. And thanks for joining me this hour as I share some wonderful swing jazz and big band music and many of the stories behind the records and the personalities who recorded them. I hope you're all having a great day. Lenny from down the block, the virtuoso of the virtual turntable and producer of the Make-Believe Ballroom, he is frantically pacing the floor of the record room which is located just a few feet away from the main Crystal studio, as he does his final checkout to make sure all the equipment needed to facilitate a successful edition of the program today is operational. So, my friend, if you feel we are ready for takeoff, let's lift those wheels off the ground with this one. Get things started on today's edition of the Make Believe Ballroom. That was I've Got My Eyes on You, Richard Himber and his orchestra, with a vocal by Marion Shaw, recorded on Royal Records in New York City in December of 1939. During last week's program, we played a few tunes by Bob Chester and his orchestra, you might recall. I hadn't played a Chester tune in more than a year, and on the show I vowed that for the next several weeks I was going to play some music by bands we haven't heard from in at least a year, and Richard Himber and his orchestra were the ones we chose today. Now, Himber, in addition to his music, I guess the best way to describe him probably would be that he was a creative, gimmicky kind of guy. To prove that, he actually had secured the first vanity phone number in the history of the telephone, which he got back in 1932, and that number was R-Himber, and he set it up with something else that was unique for that era. He had a 24-hour-a-day answering service that monitored all the calls that came to him. Now, another one of Himber's novel promotions was the design and construction of the first traveling bandstand that was placed on the back of a flatbed truck. He made one for himself and also sold a number of them. Pepsi-Cola, they loved the idea, and they sponsored Himber's bandstand for many years. The Himber Orchestra used it mostly for free outdoor concerts over the years in the New York City metropolitan area. And when that mobile bandstand was making its rounds around the sidewalks of New York, I'm sure the audiences all around the city heard Himber start the show with his theme song, It Isn't Fair. Here, Richard Himber and his orchestra, with a vocal by Joey Nash, recorded in New York City, August the 7th, 1933. Richard Himber, It Isn't Fair. Also that one written by Richard Himber himself. Next week, we'll feature another orchestra that I haven't played in more than a year, but here is an orchestra that we certainly play more than once a year because the band leader, as many of you know, is one of my favorites. How about a little later vintage Kay Kaiser? 1947, to be precise, on Columbia Records, Managua, Nicaragua, Kay Kaiser and his orchestra, vocal by Gloria Wood and the Campus Kids. ¶¶
beautiful town. You buy a hacienda for